pleasure and honour to have Mozan Beg here to speak to us this evening. He's a spokesperson for cage prisoners, and as you know, he was a British detainee at Guantanamo Bay. So I'd like you to give a round of applause to Mozan Beg.
I know that you've been discussing and watching a film in relation to people that are held on death row in the United States of America. And I'd never thought, up until Guantanamo Bay, much about the whole prison system, particularly that of the United States of America, because it's so far removed and it's so not part, or was not so much part of my reality. And then, of course, I was taken to Guantanamo Bay after a whole process, which I'll discuss with you in a minute. But it was the introduction to a particular man to whom Marie has dedicated her book that really got my mind thinking as to where I was and how dangerous this whole situation was. I had been contacted by the American Center for Constitutional Rights, who do some amazing work in relation to human rights work in the United States of America. And they had told me that we have arranged a lawyer for you, a lawyer who is different. He's different because he's the only Briton who will be given legal access to detainees in Guantanamo Bay. And that is because he's a dual citizen, because no non-Americans were given access to detainees as legal representatives. So he did come. And he came before this introduction letter. And the introduction letter said that Mr. Clive Stafford Smith, you'll be pleased to know, has been working on death row cases for the past 20 years, so you're in very safe hands. And I thought, oh my God. That's how serious this is. And although it does get a bit of a laugh now, that is really what I thought. This is terrible. This isn't good news. This means that I am literally at the worst possible stage that I could be. Particularly because, at that point, the United States had spoken about the possibility that they will be seeking the death penalty for people found guilty of whatever crimes they had created. Not that they existed, but they created after the fact in Guantanamo, where, of course, the law simply did not at that time and does not today apply if you are a detainee. It does apply if you are an iguana, because they are protected under the Endangered Species Act, any offending soldier or civilian can expect to pay up to $10,000 if they harm one of these lovable creatures. And yet, the whole process that exists in Guantanamo Bay, the military commissions process, which is being described by senior British law lords as a mockery of justice that derives from the jump of the kangaroo, has still been forced through the United States of America as far as the Guantanamo detention sites are concerned, despite the fact that three Supreme Court decisions have been passed, three, in favor of the detainees, in which they are supposedly given the right to challenge their detention through habeas corpus, i.e. that they are told that they, what crime that they've committed, so that they are charged with that and then face a court, or they are released. And this has been a veneer, it's been a sort of a decoration in the legal arguments to say that, look, America, after all of this time, has given these people the right of habeas corpus. What a great favor they have done for them. And, of course, in the legal world, there are people who have said what a marvelous victory that is for the legal system, because it shows that America does desire to give these people justice. But you ask any detainee, anyone who's detained for 7 years without charge or trial, for 7 years they've never seen their families, never phoned them, never seen them, never been able to communicate with them meaningfully, never seen their children. In some cases, children have been born shortly after the men were abducted and kidnapped from their homes, like myself, and they've never seen their children In my case, I saw him when I was released, my youngest son, and in the case of many other people, including one who is a resident of Britain, of London, where that child is growing up in this country, having never met his father, and he's nearly 7 years old. And despite all of this, that's why when the recent Supreme Court decision was passed, I had people from the media, CNN and BBC, phoning me to say, isn't it a marvelous thing that this Supreme Court decision has been passed? And I said, what, again, the third time? What difference has it made? Absolutely nothing. Because in practical, tangible terms, the most obvious thing about Guantanamo is that nobody's been convicted of any crime, and particularly in relation to the fact that Guantanamo Bay was set up because we were told that the perpetrators of 9/11, that the terrorists of this world, the most dangerous men on this planet, the worst of the worst, including myself, were there for the protection of the rest of mankind and the rest of society. That's what we were told. And yet not one person has been convicted of any crime, and not one person, not one, has been released as a result of any legal proceeding in Guantanamo Bay. But there is a process that one has to pass through before they ever make it to Guantanamo. And that process has you, at the end of it, looking forward to going to Guantanamo. Looking forward to going to the world's most notorious prison, the world's most infamous prison, the ultimate symbol of injustice that exists in the world. You are looking forward to going there. And the reason why is because you have to pass through a process. Nobody is taken from wherever they're taken from, and people have been taken from countries as wide and diverse as Zambia, Gambia, Indonesia, Azerbaijan, Germany, Jordan, Morocco, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. The processes that one must go through in a lot of these countries that have been forced to choose a side, because we're told by President Bush, you are either with us or against us. There is no in-between. So these countries, poor countries for the most part, that have been cajoled and forced either under threat of military or financial sanctions to cooperate in a process that is euphemistically called extraordinary rendition. I mean, you'd think that we're talking about the rendition of Beethoven's Fifth, but it's not. It's the rendition of human beings, and it has its roots just in the same way that the last time in history that people were taken across the Atlantic in chains by the Americans to the Americas was slavery, and it was of the darker people. And many of those, if you've ever read Roots or seen Roots, you would have known that a great deal of those people were Muslims. And that has a resonance today, because rendition, if you look it up, one of the times it was last used in terms of taking people from one place and removing them to another was when escaped slaves were rendered back to their masters. And that's the connotation of history that we're talking about, particularly in places like Bristol and Liverpool and others, that of course profited off the slave trade. And that process of extraordinary rendition is a euphemism for something much more sinister, and that is abduction, kidnap, false imprisonment, torture, and in some of the worst cases, death and murder. When I was held in the Bagram detention facility, which is where I was taken to after I'd been kidnapped in front of my wife and children in the middle of the night in Pakistan, which is where I'd evacuated to after having worked in Afghanistan on a project to build a school for girls in Taliban-administered Afghanistan, and building projects for wells in the drought-stricken regions of the Northwest. The Bagram facility, which is a place that is a converted Soviet warehouse, where you can still see the inscriptions in Russian from the last time that a superpower occupied the poorest country in Asia. And of course, I was there when the second superpower had occupied this country. And in this place, which you could almost imagine Afghan and Russians walking around together. Perhaps the Afghans would have been detained in a similar way. Indeed, I came across Afghan detainees who told me that their fathers had been detained in the very same place that I was now being detained, or their children were being detained by the Americans in their own lands. And in this place, Bagram, it was such that you could hear the footsteps every night and the screams of people being interrogated. The footsteps, of course, were the soldiers walking up, marching up and down, watching us with the lights on 24 hours a day and the generators that powered them, so there was the hum of the generators that were outside. And there was the screams of the detainees who were being interrogated, or the interrogators that were screaming at them to break them. Now, just about 3 to 4 months ago, there's a film that was released. It was called Taxi to the Dark Side. And it won the Oscar. It won the Oscar because I'm in it. No. I am in it. It did win the Oscar, but not because I'm in it. It won the Oscar because it questioned America at its rawest. It put to it questions that America couldn't answer at the time, at the similar given time, that the Vietnam, My Lai massacres and things like that had taken place. So it's still very raw with the Americans, and that's why it hasn't been as publicized as well as it should have been, but nonetheless, they saw fit, and rightly so, to give this film the Oscar. And the reason why it's called Taxi to the Dark Side is because it's about a taxi driver, an Afghan taxi driver, who was in my cell. And he was at the front of my cell the night that he died. But he didn't die of natural. The death certificate in his case says that he received blunt force strikes on his legs that caused his blood to clot and for him to die. His legs looked as if they had been pulverized or driven over by a truck, and these are the quotes from the death certificates, and that had he survived, he would have required his leg to be amputated. Now, the reason why this man died is because they had a process in Bagram, which was shock and awe. And this meant that whoever's brought into custody must first be dragged through the mud with a hood over their head, with their hands shackled behind their backs and their legs shackled, kicked and punched and spat at and screamed at, and dogs brought over so closely that you could feel the saliva of the snarling dog dripping onto your skin. And then a knife taken to your trousers and to your shirt or whatever you're wearing, and cut the clothing off so that you could feel the cold blade of the steel as it glided against your skin. And then taken in this manner, in naked, and being shaved so that if you were like the majority of people in Afghanistan, the men in Afghanistan who have beards and hair, that if they were to look at themselves in the mirror, they would not know who they were. They wouldn't recognize themselves. And then to be taken in this manner and to be interrogated by the FBI, by the CIA, by military intelligence, with people standing with M16s, shotguns and handguns around in the chamber, just in case, on your knees. And this was the manner in which we were brought into custody and held. And that was just the process of beginning, the initiation ceremony of how you now have become, as they said, the property of the United States of America, and you have no rights. And these are the terms used verbatim to us as detainees, that you have no rights, meaning you have no human rights because you are not human. And therefore you'll be treated accordingly. And part of that treatment meant that you would be dehumanized to the point that because you look different, because most of the people detained in Afghanistan in the war on terror are Muslims, and most of the Muslims come from either Asia or Africa. So therefore, they would be darker skinned. They would speak either Swahili, Urdu, Arabic, Pashto, Farsi, Uyghur, Turkish. Very few of them would be speaking English. And therefore, the process has already begun. We see that in this country. We see that in this country, how people can be dehumanized simply because they speak a different language, and they look different, or they are different. So that process has already begun. Then on top of that, of course, the most powerful men, and arguably the most stupid men on earth, had already designated us and the detainees there as the worst of the worst. In fact, Clive Stafford Smith has written a book called Bad Men. And the reason why he's called it Bad Men is compliments of President Bush, who said, "I don't know what these folk have done, but I know they're bad men." And as a result of this, as a penny drops, it drops down and doesn't go up. It's the same in the US military. But as far as the system there is concerned, when a statement is made, it drops down, and it drops down to the enlisted soldier, who then interprets what has been said at the top according to their reality. And then they administer that interpretation in tangible terms, and they administer it upon us, the aliens, which is what we've been described as. We've been described as enemy combatants and enemy aliens, i.e. people that are different, foreign, subhuman. And that's how, coming back to the story of this taxi driver who'd been picked up for no other reason other than that he drove past the place that had been attacked by an RPG, a rocket propelled grenade that was an American base. And they managed to get the first person that was there. He was exonerated of having committed any wrong, but only after he was dead. And the story of what happened that night, that fateful night that I will never forget, is that he was taken to the front of the cell and put after his shock and awe capture to be broken down into the front of the cell area, a cell area called the airlock, which is where a person is isolated before they are either brought into or taken out of the cell from the other prisoners. And he was tied like so, on his tiptoes. So tight, cutting into his skin, the shackles were on his wrists, that if he tried to relax, there's pain into your wrists, cutting more. So you have to try to get back up again. Hour passed, 2 hours passed, 4, 10, 12, 24, 48. He continued to be in this position, moaning, complaining. Sometimes they let him out just to go to the bathroom or to eat. But other than that, that was the position. And I too, like many other people, was put in that position. Not as long as he was, but nevertheless, that was part of the punishment that we received for just speaking to the person on the opposite or adjacent sides to us. Speaking was an infraction against the rules. If you speak, if you look like you're speaking, if you make a prayer and you whisper it, that is deemed to be attempting to speak to the person that's next to you. And if you've done that, you are now trying to communicate, because if you're communicating, therefore, you must be up to no good. So that's why I said to you, you could hear the footsteps, you could hear the screams, because everything else was silent. You were not allowed to speak. And so he remained in this position until I saw him, from his tiptoes, relax, and his head drop. He was, of course, at that point where the pain no longer mattered. The pain didn't matter anymore. So the guards then later came in, they opened the cell door, they undid the shackles from the top. But as they did that, they began to punch him in the ribs. Rib strikes, big, huge American guards. Just to see if he was putting it on or not, because of course we're terrorists, and a lot of terrorists make all sorts of ploys and plans and try to deceive people and are manipulators. So therefore, let's be careful and be sure. And they began to punch him, and they dropped him onto the ground, and then they kneed him into his head and kneed him in his back and tied his hands behind his back, shackled his legs, and carried him off to the isolation room that was even smaller than the airlock. It's a tiny little room that measures 3 foot by 3 foot, and that's where he was taken. That's the last room that he was in before he met his maker. And again in there, that room, and this is based on the testimony, not of myself, but the testimony of the American soldiers who were involved in his death, that they tied him up again, left him in that position. They knew that he hadn't done anything wrong. By this time, they were coming to the conclusion that this man didn't know anything. But there was one mistake that he made, that at one point, he tried to struggle free because he was still alive. And by doing so, he unleashed the wrath of one of the American soldiers who applied to him the peroneal strike, which is like a Thai boxing style kick from the knee to the thigh. And it is contained within the standard operating procedure to subdue a detainee who is uncooperative. problem is that when he did that, when he struck him, this detainee, this taxi driver said, "Allah, Allah, my God, my God." And other soldiers heard him say, "Allah, Allah." So other soldiers came along and they administered to him another peroneal strike. And he said, "Allah, Allah," again. And that night he said, "Allah, Allah," 200 times. And that's what led to his leg being pulverized in the way that it was. And the soldiers had not even thought that perhaps we should even strike him in the other leg. If we're going to strike him, let's not do it at the same place. He died that night, but people have died there before, and I'd seen that happen. And it's unsurprising that that happened, because in reality, when we know in the name of the deaths of the people who died tragically, wrongfully, on September the 11th, that number was 2,976, at least we know how many died. We do know. We're constantly told about it, especially as a Muslim. You will never, ever be made to forget. They will harp on about it until we're gone from this planet. In the same way as July the 7th. We will never be made to forget this. And we, as Tony Blair said, as a Muslim community, have to take the responsibility, carry the responsibility, he said, as a Muslim community for terrorism. He even said to the black community that they have to carry the responsibility for knife crime. So then, of course, we have to ask this question. Who takes the responsibility for the people that have died in Iraq and Afghanistan as after the launch of Operation, bizarrely named Enduring Freedom, because I've always thought that freedom isn't something that you endure. Freedom is supposed to be something that you cherish from the point that you're born to the point that you die. The things, rather, that you endure are torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. But the question has to be asked. In the name of the deaths of 2,976 people, how many have been killed? The answer is, nobody has a clue, nobody knows, nobody cares, because, here's the pun, nobody counts. The dead don't count, and we don't count them. Is it 100,000? Is it 2 million? Give or take 800,000? Give or take 1,800,000? Who gives a damn? Doesn't matter. How many people died in Afghanistan in the first week alone of Operation Enduring Freedom? I had moved to Afghanistan with my wife and children to work on a project to build schools, as I said. And we had to evacuate under the cruise missiles, under the carpet bomb of daisy cutters. Again, euphemistically named, it sounds so nice, doesn't it? A daisy cutter, it sounds like a lawnmower on a Sunday afternoon. It's not. It's a 1,500-pound TNT bomb, and they drop it in a series, and that's why they call it carpet bombing, because it blanketly destroys our whole area. And you think it discriminates between women and children and animals, dogs and cats and mice and ants? No, it doesn't. Do you seriously think that this bombing somehow is a justification or a response to what happened on September 11th, when that happened simply in the first week, let alone what's happened in the past 6 years with the invasion of Iraq that followed directly as a result of something that occurred in Bagram, the place where this man was murdered? The answer is, of course, there is no justification. The answer, of course, is that we are too afraid to say what the reality is. That if the striking of people on September the 11th was terrorism, which led to their deaths, and it is in my book, then what do we call what has led to the deaths, either directly or indirectly, under the types of weapons I've described? What do we call that? And why is it that we're so picky and choosy when we use the term terrorism? If you look at the word terrorism, you'll find the first time it entered the history of the English language was from the Terror, from France, the Great Terror. But that introduced democracy to the West, so that's okay. That made it okay. 40,000 people were killed and massacred, including by the guillotine. But that's all right. The new modern definitions of terrorism almost completely remove the idea or the notion that states can be responsible for terrorism, that it is only individuals and groups. And that is the frightening part, because accountability just completely goes out of the window there. Because what you're saying is that governments can do no wrong. And it is only the average, ordinary person who has to bear the brunt of government policy and attitude. That is extremely, extremely frightening. But listen to this. There is something that occurred in Bagram that I said led to the war in Iraq directly. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't understand the connotation of how serious it was. But it was this. I was interrogated by the CIA in Bagram in the same rooms where these people were beaten to death. In the rooms where I heard the screams of women I was led to believe was my wife being tortured next door. When they waved pictures of my children in front of me and said, "You think that they're free? Do you think they're okay? What do you think we did with them that night that we came to your house and took you in front of them? Do you think we just left them alone?" And during this time, they told me that there was a Libyan man, Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libyan, who I'm sure, I believe everybody, if they don't know, should know his case, because it is affecting everybody's lives as a result of what happened to this man. This man was said to be one of the most senior ranking members of Al-Qaeda. He's now no longer said to be this. But that doesn't matter, because it was trumpeted at the time we have captured one of Osama bin Laden's many right-hand men. And of course, he has many right-hand men. He also, just like there are many 20th hijackers, somebody's not good at math somewhere. But they said of this man that he was working with Saddam Hussein to obtain weapons of mass destruction. And how they said this was that they sent him to Egypt. They sent him to Egypt via the USS Bataan, which is a ship that was in the Persian Gulf. And they sent him in a coffin, alive, with a few holes drilled out so that he could breathe. And then from that point, they sent him to Egypt. And in Egypt, he was waterboarded. And for those of you who don't know what waterboarding is a concept that in Spanish is called tortura del agua, which means water, torture of the water. It was first introduced during the Spanish Inquisition. At least they, at that time, had no inhibitions or qualms about calling it what it was, torture. Today, President Bush said it's not torture, it's just enhanced, robust interrogation techniques. Waterboarding simply means that a person is tied to the ground, tied to a board, water is poured over his face so that he can no longer breathe, and the only thing that he can breathe is water, which goes into the lungs, and he tells himself that he's drowning, so he's ready to give up whatever there is before he suffocates. This man was waterboarded, and during the waterboarding, he confessed that he was working on obtaining weapons of mass destruction from Saddam Hussein. And this was told to me by the CIA, who also threatened to send me to Bagram, to Egypt, if I didn't cooperate. In 2003, unbeknownst to me at the time, Colin Powell went to the Security Council arguing for a case of war in Iraq. And he cited this case. We have credible and reliable evidence from a man that we have captured who is now safely in our custody, being neutralized, that he was working on obtaining weapons of mass destruction and working with Saddam. Let us go into Iraq. And they did, based on this and other dodgy dossiers. As a result of that, of course, the deaths that I've spoken of in Iraq began. Ibn al-Sheikh, however, retracted the statement. The CIA accepted that what he had said was under duress, but it didn't matter, because Ibn al-Sheikh didn't have the privilege of being sent to Guantanamo, where he would have eventually been given access to people like Clive Stafford Smith, who know that his case could never have been fought in the court of law, because the law doesn't apply, but in the court of public opinion, Ibn al-Sheikh's case would have had massive connotations. So Ibn al-Sheikh, conveniently, like scores of others, has now disappeared. And last year, my organization, Cage Prisoners, Human Rights Watch, Reprieve, which is Clive's organization, Amnesty International, and the Center for Constitutional Rights, produced a report called Off the Record. And it documented specifically the cases who have disappeared. Not the people who, as I said, have been fortunate enough to make it to Guantanamo, but those people who are off the record, have disappeared Argentina, Chile, junta style. And that is the sort of situation where we are in, where the law simply does not matter, where clandestine operations have been justified continually in the name of protecting national security. Remember, this operation was launched under the guise or the title of Operation Enduring Freedom. And it's the notion, it's the argument that's given to the rest of the world that this is all about freedom, protecting and defending freedom. So much so that if you go to Guantanamo Bay, you will see a plaque, it's bizarre, outside every camp, whether that camp houses children, and there are children in Guantanamo now who are now, of course, no longer children because they've been there that long, they've grown into adults. Or whether it's the signature camp X-ray that you've seen with people kneeling down in orange suits with the masks over their faces so that they don't bite through the cable of the aircraft because they're like rabid dogs. Or the earmuffs because they might hear something untoward. Or the blackened out goggles they're made to wear. Or the hoods, they're made to look like the extraterrestrials we're told that they are. Or whether it's Camp Echo, where I was held, which is maximum security isolation, where you have no contact with any human being other than the guards. Or whether it's the new camps that are state-of-the-art, supermax, electronic prisons that have been built at the cost of tens of millions of dollars. You see this plaque outside every single camp. It says, honor bound to defend freedom. That's the bizarre part, because there's there are two parts of this, of course, that sound completely ridiculous. Where's the honor in removing somebody's freedom without charge or trial? Nobody knows the answer to that question, but if you ask the average American soldier, they'll simply say that we are following orders. And that is one of the really stark parts about all of this, because as people in Europe and America know, and Nuremberg was the evidence for this, is that a soldier cannot plead that he was simply acting under orders when committing a crime that is immoral, illegal, and just wrong. You can't say, I was simply acting and following my orders. Because there is an onus upon a human being to recognize there are some things that are inviolable. And that's why we have Geneva Conventions. That's why we have United Nations Conventions against torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. And yet, that seems to be the order of the day, and it continues. So much so that you can hear about, when I spoke of waterboarding, you know, recently, that the CIA said that we recorded these interrogation sessions. And rightly so, because if you're going to interrogate one of the most dangerous men in the world, you want to have on record what he said. But they didn't realize, of course, at the time, that somebody along the line would call for these records to be made public under the Public Information Acts. So conveniently, they destroyed these tapes, and they admitted to destroying them. And their reason? We were protecting the identities of our intelligence agents. Not that there was any torture taking place at all, no, they didn't want to hide anything about that, because they're quite clear, waterboarding is not torture, so that's okay. And that's the sort of reality where we're in, where the most senior legal advisor to the US government, Alberto Gonzalez, argued that for something to constitute torture, it has to include severe physical impairment, like organ failure or death, otherwise it's not torture. That is the most senior legal advisor to the US government. Now, the question we all have to ask ourselves is that perhaps part of it, many of us are against the war, we're against torture, we support human rights and so forth. We marched, we demonstrated, we did all that was possible. But why hasn't it stopped? Why is it worse? That's a question that everybody has to answer.
Well, it's a very, very
tricky subject because, in all honesty, yesterday's terrorists, yesterday's freedom fighters are indeed today's terrorists. One of the greatest examples of this, of course, is Afghanistan itself. The Mujahideen, and if you take the word jihad today, it's almost synonymous with terrorism in the Western world. It's regarded as a noble concept in the Eastern world. But if you take that word now, it's been introduced into the English language, it's been anglicized. Jihadist, jihadism, all sorts of stuff that don't make sense. And yet, the Mujahideen during the 80s were supported by the Soviet, by the Americans and by the Brits who were brought over here to be trained in weapons of like the Stingers and so forth, to defeat the Soviets. They weren't terrorists here, but they were terrorists to the Soviets. The Soviets called them terrorists. So it's really important to recognize that it's those who are in power that dictate who and why and when somebody will call a terrorist. The French resistance used tactics of terrorism. They used bombing, they used gunning down methods, they used all sorts of methods to kill Nazi occupiers. But I've not heard one person in the West refer to them as terrorists. They were freedom fighters. La Résistance, the resistance. And so I think it's important to recognize that is why there is a discrepancy, and that is why there are over 200 definitions, because there isn't one clear one. The first definitions, as I said, if you look at how the concept entered the English language, it entered nothing to do. It was nothing to do with sort of clandestine killing. It was very open killing. The French Revolution that brought about the guillotine and so forth, the massacre of ordinary people, was called the Great Terror. And it was known at that time that its populaces or its governments can carry out acts of repression which are terror. Today, as I said, if you look at one of the American Heritage dictionaries, it actually defines terrorism with individuals or organizations that are involved in subverting or applying pressure through ideological or military means to change, to bring about a change. It doesn't mention governments. And I think that's a very, very terrible mistake people are making today.
You talked about rendition. I mean, we've had this slightly weird situation where you've got kind of emergent plane spotters in Britain phoning up national newspapers and getting stories in about these CIA flights, and the illegal, supposedly illegal CIA flights. And also, I think Des Brown, the Defence Secretary, as well as the senior policeman who, bizarrely, he was found suicide on top of Snowden, was actually the senior policeman in Britain who had done an inquiry into the process of rendition and found that it wasn't taking place. I mean, we've had lots of strange stuff going on around this whole rendition business. And also, we've had, you know, actually some, you know, what you might call a little bit of light as well, with this SAS soldier, Ben Griffin, speaking out about it, saying, actually, rendition is happening. And I wonder if you think that this is a from your perspective, is something that we really can do something about to stop these flights?
I'd never thought that there'd be a time that I would be talking about the great merits of people who carry out plane spotting and train spotting. But there you go. Everybody has a use you'd never have to spend any money. And Stephen Gray has authored a fantastic book, which I think we have somewhere, called Ghost Plane, in which he documents and, of course, brings to light the fact that the extraordinary renditions process began well before September 11th. It began, I think, around the time, around 1996, with the renditions of some people in Bosnia and Herzegovina and so forth. I have met also with Ben Griffin recently, who is, for those of you who don't know, a former British SAS soldier. You don't get better than the SAS in this country. They are the creme de la creme, probably the best soldiers in the world. And yet, this man bravely took on the establishment and said, what I have seen taking place in the name of protecting our securities is completely the opposite. He told me how, actually I'm not supposed to say some of the things because he's on a gag order, so we'll not go into all of that. But suffice to say that a man who has dedicated his entire life to this, some of the most toughest training in the world, for him to walk out on this principle, needs to be heard. He really needs to be heard. And even people like Patrick Mercer from the Conservative Party said that he needs to be heard. But what he has to say, they will not like, not the Labour Party and not the Conservatives. we can do about the renditions, first of all, is recognize, and I think there was a continual campaign from different organizations who, and this was particularly from the Liberal Democrats or some of them, who kept on hammering home to the point to the British government, have British territory been used for extraordinary rendition flights? And they'd always denied it, even though senior American military men in the beginning had slipped out that they were holding people in Diego Garcia, which of course is British territory. Last year, I think it was David Miliband, who said, oh, by the way, we are sorry, British territory was used for holding or allowing the passage of people being extraordinarily rendered. And those people, of course, were waterboarded too. Accountability is what it's all about, I think, in answer to your question, is it has to be a dogged accountability. People have to keep asking, pursue them, never let them rest until they are brought to book, until they are made to spill the beans in public in the way that they've had. But the sad thing about that admission was that what followed was nothing. How can somebody say, oh, well, we're sorry, that's it, we lied? That seems to be the order of the day. And I think it requires people to be continuous. You have to carry out a struggle of attrition.
Just to go back to your point about terrorism and being part of the democratic process in Northern Ireland, for example, of course, Derry Adams and Martin McGinnison are part of the Assembly. And all the time in the 80s, when the British government said they would talk to terrorists, they were, of course, negotiating. And I think there are points where you can't keep comparing now because we're in uncharted waters. But I just wondered if, in your opinion, are they talking to Al Qaeda, or are there, behind all this horrible charade that you've described, is there any negotiation going on?
I believe that there is a desire in some circles, and probably more in the Foreign Office because of its historical relations to the rest of the world, that is happening. There is a desire for it. I'd just like to say, as far as Northern Ireland is concerned, I've been there many times, and I've met even with Gerry Adams and many former prisoners to try to understand what this process means. Is this process possible with what we have today, or is it completely amorphous and completely different? Regardless, Des Brown conceded, I think, at the last Labour Party conference that there can be no peace in Afghanistan without the inclusion of the Taliban. That is a bizarre and a very powerful thing for him to say, but he would never have said it had Tony Blair been around. Recently, of course, some of Tony Blair's former advisors have said that there has to be discussion with Al-Qaeda. Now, this is very difficult in an atmosphere when everybody, the left and the right to a degree, fall into the trap of accepting the versions that have been given about who people are. When we're told, right, this person is so-and-so, nobody even cares to think, can they possibly have anything that is worth putting on a table that can be discussed? Now, the parallel with Northern Ireland is extremely important because Gerry Adams, of course, was ludicrously not allowed to have his voice broadcast on British airwaves, which, of course, made him even more popular, because people then started to see how ludicrous this is. So perhaps it requires a type of madness for people then to wake up and say, look how stupid this is. Tony Blair's lasting legacy will always be the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, but he wanted the pinnacle of his time in power to be that he bought, at the end of a very long process, which he wasn't part of all the way through, Ian Paisley and Martin McGuinness together to shake hands, and they are now sharing power in Stormont. But is that process possible with the Muslim world, which includes Algeria, and Iraq, and Afghanistan, and Pakistan, and all these places? It has to have the answers are going to be extremely unpalatable. That's where they're going to run. If you want to negotiate peace with people, if you want to start, of course, Britain has to start with Britain and not everywhere else. If you want to start with Britain, then you've got to start looking at the most unpalatable places. And are people ready to do that? That's the question.
Can you push me first? Yes, at the back, sorry.
What worries me about this rendition process once people are in the system, they are obviously able to manipulate it. Yeah, there's no legal process here. And this allows the state to set up terrorist organisations which are manipulable, which they can then pretend to chase. I mean, that's pretty much what it looks to me like Al-Qaeda is, by and large. Not entirely, but we, as you said earlier, in the 80s, it was quite clear what was going on. And in particular, in relation to the 7/7 bombs tragedies 3 years ago, in the weeks after the bombing, the Metropolitan Police named a particular individual, Haroun Aswat, as the mastermind, potentially mastermind of the bombings. But it then transpired that he'd been running around the world being arrested and let loose because he was an MI6 double agent, according to the Americans. Yeah? Now, he's now in Belmarsh without any lawyer or support because he's in that system, and apparently he's going to go to Gitmo. Now, in other words, what they can do is say there is an individual like that, which is a kind of transitional individual, a terrorist who's also a double agent. When that gets discovered, you stick him in the rendition system, and nobody can ever find out what happened. And of course, this allows the state to orchestrate terrorist events. I'm not saying that 7/7 was orchestrated, although we have very serious suspicions about it. But the point is that the rendition process gives the state carte blanche to create provocations.
Yeah, just to comment on Harun Rashid's case, it's something that I know very well. Gareth Pearce is his lawyer. She's also my lawyer, but he is in the system where he is detained without charge and without trial on an extradition treaty that is non-reciprocal. They don't require showing a prima facie case. Therefore, he has been detained in that manner, and he's been hospitalized, so now he's not in Belmarsh anymore, he's in Broadmoor. So that's destroyed his mind. But the reality of all of these sorts of things that exist is that, you know, there is simply there's no process. The new process we have today is that there isn't one. There isn't a process that says to you, if you're going to be detained now, that you can look forward to having your day in court. That simply doesn't exist anymore. We are at a time where, my goodness, you know, at the height of the IRA attacks, which culminated in the strike of 10 Downing Street. 10 Downing Street was struck by a court martial bomb. As far as a military operation is concerned, you can't get better than that. And yet, detention without trial at the time was 3 days. 3 days? Today, we're at 42 days. And Blair, if you remember, didn't want 42 days. He wanted 90 days. 90 days. I mean, and that's the real... And he's one of the most popular prime ministers in recent history, too. So that does say something about how people react, because they voted him into power. Now, there's all sorts of questions about how many people voted and how many people didn't, and or whatever, but the fact is he did come back into power three times, or two times. So, it may nearly have happened. That may have happened, that we could have got 90 days, and perhaps if another, you know, attack takes place, and I pray that it doesn't, that's precisely what we will be. And we have the highest rate of detention without trial, of days of detention without trial. But put that argument aside. The government has already the ability to intern people, and they have done so in the wake of September 11th, and then again with the same people who were not involved in July the 5th because they were in prison. And yet they were re-interned, and now some have been released on the most strictest control orders that are more restrictive than Aung San Suu Kyi's house arrest in Burma, and that's here in Britain. A land of habeas corpus. And so I think I agree with you in the sense that there needs to be inquiries, and there, but more than that, there needs to be accountability. And that just simply doesn't happen.
Just time for a really quick yes.
I just wanted to ask a slightly more personal question in the sense that
I charge for those.
What did you say, sorry?
I charge for those.
I just wondered, you know, how you've managed to go through experiences you have come through with so much clarity and sanity. You know, what was it that kept you going? What keeps you going now?
Well, you're making the assumptions about clarity and sanity based on what you've seen, not what you haven't seen. But the short answer is, of course, you know, your answers are in there, and you can get them for 799.
That's very sad.
time for self-pity. There is no time to dwell upon the most difficult and the harshest period of my life, because there are people who are still going through it. And they're not just going through it there, they're going through it here in less harsh circumstances, but nonetheless, it is happening. And that's the world that I've returned to. I didn't return to a world that was the same as how I've left it. It has become more like, I'm not saying it is, but it's become more like a police state. And particularly, I can't mince my words with this, particularly if you happen to be a Muslim. And therefore, my time has been spent between readjusting with my family, trying to learn who they are, and they are in return trying to learn who I am. When I returned, of course, there was a three-year-old child, and he was nearly four, actually, that I'd never seen. And of course, while I'd gone, he'd conveniently taken my place in the bed. So when I returned, I kicked him out. And he didn't like that very much. So there are things like that that I have to deal with that have all sorts of repercussions. My eldest daughter, was about 6 years old when I saw her last. I used to still be able to pick her up in the air and throw her and catch her and tickle her and cuddle her. When I returned, I couldn't do that. It's too heavy. You can't do that with a 10-year-old. So there are all sorts of things like that that are very difficult to deal with. But on top of that, I've had to return to meeting children who are now, as I said, 7, 8 years old, who've never seen their fathers, and ask me questions like, when is my dad coming home? Couldn't he afford the plane ticket? Does he need a map? These are questions that they've asked me. Does he need a map? Was there no space on the plane? And why? Because these guys are not British citizens. And that is, when you hear things like that, you can't afford to dwell on any self-pity or worry about what happens. Because the relief of returning outweighs and overshadows all of that bitterness that exists. And I'm not bitter, but I continue to campaign with as much passion as I can, because although I'm prepared to forgive 1,000 times over, and I have done so with some of the individual soldiers who have asked me to do so, who were my guards in Guantanamo, I have no right to forgive on anybody else's behalf.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for campaigning here, and it's been a real privilege to listen to you and hear of these terrible experiences, and to see what a magnificent survivor you've been and continue to be. And everybody, come and buy Rosen's book, Enemy Combatant. And we'd like to thank you very much again for coming back to Bristol.
Although perhaps people don't know much about the stories of the men in Guantanamo, and Enemy Combatant is my book, and it's about growing up in Britain in the 70s and the 80s, and what it's like to go through that process of being an Asian immigrant, second generation, and so forth, and then Guantanamo, and then return. But there's a book here called Poems from Guantanamo, and it is an anthology of poetry written by people who are, in some cases, still in Guantanamo. They were all written in Guantanamo. One of them is mine. Some of these poems were actually scratched out, etched out with fingernails onto paper cups, because some of these men had no pen and no paper. So take a look at it when you get a chance. Yeah. And there are leaflets here about the work that Kate Prisoners does. If you're